Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. My name's Pip Adam and this is episode 40. That's right, we've made 40 episodes of Better Off Red. And the only reason we've been able to make 40 episodes of Better Off Red is that extremely generous people have agreed to be on the podcast and have taken time out of their week and let me talk to them with a recorder on. It sounds like an easy thing, but it's no mean feat, and I'm really grateful to everyone that's been on the show, so thank you very, very much. Also, I'm very grateful to the people that listen. Thanks heaps for keeping listening. I really appreciate that. It's wonderful. You're wonderful. And also, thank you to people that follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks heaps for that. And also, thanks heaps to Brent McIntyre, who continues to help me with production so much. So thank you very, very much for that. So what shall we do for episode 40? It just happens to coincide with one of the big nights for literature in Wellington. Saturday the 12th of November 2016, just in case you're listening in 2035, here in Wellington, in Aotearoa, is Lit Crawl. It's this fantastic festival organised by Claire Maybe and Andrew Larking. It's a one-day festival with a couple of satellite events around it. There's a couple of events on Friday and at other times, but the main event is 12th of November, 6 p.m. till late. What happens is, just in multiple venues around the Wellington CBD, literature just takes over. There are readings and just the most wonderful discussions and conversations about books and literature and journalism, and yeah, I highly recommend it. You can find a program for Lit Crawl at litcrawl.co.nz. That's litcrawl. .co.nz. At 7:15, as part of Lit Crawl at RDB's, is an event called Open Hearts, New Writing from Starling. Starling is an online literary journal showcasing the best new poetry and prose from young New Zealand writers. So what we've done with this episode today is to explore this Starling wonderful thing. And so we talked a couple of weeks ago. I sat down with Louise Wallace, who is the founder and editor, and Frances Cook, who is the co-editor of Starling, and we had a chat about the journal, how it started, how it's carried on, that sort of thing. So there are two issues of Starling out already, and you can look at those at starlingmag.com. There's a third one coming out in January. I highly recommend having a look. There's some amazing work on there. So some of the amazing work is also in this podcast as well. I was really grateful to several writers who either sent in audio files or came and we did a recording. So there are some readings here from Sharon Lamb, Georgie Johnson, Claudia Jardine, Rebecca Hawkes, Lily Ng, Rian Gaffney, Sophia Van Wardenberg, and Nina Poles. So you'll get to hear some writing from Starling as well. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Thank you again for everything. And yeah, come along to Lit Crawl. It'll be awesome.
Claudia Jardine, Kashmir Wanderers Under 15s. I had always wanted to be captain of the football team. I had a big voice and big legs, and I always did my best to get along with the other girls. Maybe I was too inconsistent on the field, or maybe it was that one time I told the coach's daughter to stop fucking around and kick the bloody ball. Killers. Every summer they put up the signs saying no fires, and every summer we ignore them. The sky above the ranges was going shy, blushing and hiding in the skirts of the hills. We walked the beach in search of dry driftwood and kindling, brushing hands but never really holding on. I had a guitar slung over one shoulder, remembering an evening long ago when my sandals had washed off the rocks, the look on my mother's face when I returned after dark, feet and cheeks marred with tears. After that particular summer, The Walrus and the Carpenter became my favourite carol piece. Hindsight had just revealed this correlation when you swung a warm, sunburnt arm around my waist, but this wasn't what made me stop. Their movements melted the mirror of the bay. Each ripple gave away the bulk hidden beneath. The two fins offshore gently reminded us why you don't swim alone at dusk, before slipping behind the islands, like slipshod yachts out in a southerly. We took it as a good omen and piled the bonfire high, offering burnt marshmallows as votives to slippery gods, who can knock seals from ice floes by making waves in military formation.
Nina Poles. Miyazaki Bloom. I feel things happening around me that are not real. I must be in a dream, or in a movie, or watching a movie on an airplane in a dream. On the other side of the field there are blossom trees in full bloom. They are pale, barely pink, like branches covered in fake snow. I hear the wind begin to rise and think of how, in movies, the wind is always a sound at first. I push my hair out of my eyes and see petals fall from the trees in thick waves, like something from a Miyazaki film. The sky is that same imaginary blue. My first thought is not of snow, but of volcanic ash, of children shaking white dust out of their hair. I see a layer of white petals on the grass. If the wind kept shaking the trees and the ash flowers kept falling and everything became coated in dust petals, they would soon get in our eyes, in our pockets, in our shoes, on park benches, inside rubbish bins, inside our mouths. You belong nowhere in this spring apocalyptic scene. I didn't build it for you. But soon you are standing next to me, looking at me but not straight at me, and we are laughing and making handprints in the dust, listening to the wind blow them away. If Catherine Mansfield were my best friend. 1. She would teach me how to apply winged eyeliner in a moving vehicle. She would write long, passionate texts to her high school crush, then screw up her eyes and ask me to press send quickly before she changed her mind. She would let me borrow her vintage coats, her bright silk scarves, her oversized sunglasses, and her Frida Kahlo socks. When I'm in the middle of a breakup, she would come over when I can't get to sleep, and we would sit on the floor eating Russian fudge, watching documentaries about serial killers. 2. Once we'd saved up enough money, we would go see the cherry blossoms like she always wanted to, and drink chrysanthemum tea beneath the moon. And we would climb mountains that look just like the mountains in Chinese paintings, and we would sit on the edge of the cliff, eating mangoes out of our hands, dangling our feet into the clouds. 3. Then we would move cities, then countries. At the beginning, we would write, then we wouldn't anymore. But sometimes I'd get an email from an unknown address. Subject line, magnolia flowers. And then we'd collide by a river in Shanghai, or on a crosswalk in New York. And we would spend one sunburst afternoon running through art galleries, watching dogs at the dog park, taking pictures of each other's shadows. The years would pile up and she'd get harder to find. But I would always remember that one New Year's Eve when we were young, when she decided not to turn up to her own party, sneaking out instead to light sparklers and swim naked in the cold sea, white gold fireworks exploding like lightning in the sky over the harbour, lights blooming in her eyes.
Georgie Johnson, Bonfire. Sun's going down, blue-veiled tussocks, pavement still warm. Cool breeze, though. I forgot jandals, but I got a jersey, your little sister's, I think. Still fits. There's excitement in our steps, bits of shell and stone to the beach. Tonight, someone's gonna get kissed. And you, me, we got sticks, wood, driftwood, all bony and marrowed like dry bones. Osteoporosis. They started to light it. Was worried there was too many, didn't want it to burn too high. Always worrying like that, I was. And I was right, it was huge. And it rushed up and flamed us into shadows and silhouettes against the quiet sea. Omniscient, constant. Presences that quell an unease in a lot of us, more excitement. And your freckles flicker in between the smoke and you sing into my hair. someone desperately strumming on that guitar. Your hair is in my mouth, a strand, but I leave it. And one of them, the guy with the bottle, is luring you nearer and I get nervous. And the moment is slipping away and the sea gets louder, and when I try and get your attention back, you've got the bottle to your mouth now. My arms pushed hard to my breasts. Try to stop the pound, the throb, my chest. And your smile, his hand on your neck. Your hair is still in my mouth. Someone's going to get kissed. Carver. Jimmy came home and said, guess what? Guess what? What, I say. He tells me to guess, so I guess. Cats, dogs. It's raining all the time in Wellington. He laughs and says, no. Carver. Alice is getting excited. And Jimmy says from the kitchen, the largest bowl up, ready. This is the good stuff. And I help Alice balance on a stool. She wants the fabric to hang like this. It hangs from the light shade like this. Careful, I say. And I imagine all sorts of things at once. But someone has already put on the reggae. No worries, man. Get over here, Jimmy yells. He's squeezing the Carver tight. Pretty sure that's my old t-shirt he's using that I tried to get rid of last summer. Touch it. Feels like clay in there. A limb of flesh out of the pore of the fabric. Brown oozes. Alice giggles, her hands on her face. It looks like the Hutt River. Don't worry, mate, Jimmy yarns, tastes like it too. And we take turns, twisting, pulling that poor arm. And before we know it, the bowl is full. Meanwhile, Alice has finished the posse, burning things. Moths, open flames, gathered round on cushions, duvets piled. A fabulous pyre, the perfect place to lie back. Jimmy looks around at us. Face is semi-lit pink. He clasps a mug of the good stuff. On a lumpy cushion from here, we watch his face clench, then smile. A leaf of something caught between his front teeth. Pass it around. To the left, someone says. We wait. Numb lips, numb tongue, coldness, forlorn. And before long, we'd packed up, tent dismantled, ridden into some far corner of the house. A few pillows left as debris. All the while, that leaf stayed there, crooking his smile. I held on to the thought of that leaf coming all the way from someone's yard, past grounded root into plastic baggy, sweaty car ride, dog in the back fogging up the window, twisted and squeezed, drank in a tent made from a sheet that hangs like this, only to be caught in a smile.
Okay, so, hello Louise. Hello. Hi. Francis.
Hello.
Yes, the beginning is always very awkward. We are sitting in a nice lounge. This is a very nice lounge. Thanks for having us, Louise. It's very
You're
nice.
Welcome.
And I am here with Louise Wallace and Francis Cook, and we are going to talk about Starling, which is very exciting. So, maybe we can just start off with one of you sort of, when someone says to you, what is Starling Journal? How do you describe it?
I mean, we've got a one-line kind of summary that wraps it all up, which is generally that it's an online literary journal for New Zealand writers under 25 years old. And, yeah, I guess that's the, I mean, that's the kind of criteria for it, and that's where we started from.
Cool. And, like, what led to you creating the journal? Can you remember what you were thinking when that started?
I can remember because Louise sent me a text message.
Okay.
Saying, I have an amazing idea that we need to do.
Okay.
And that was about
a
long time ago.
Yeah, because I think before, so we started it last year, obviously, mm-hmm. but before, it had been about 4 years since then, because I looked back through my emails to figure it out. And because I remember I'd talked to Francis about it at the time, and I also emailed Bill Manhire just for some feedback on the concept. And yeah, so it was kind of a long gestation of this idea. But I mean, the main reason for the idea, I suppose, was my own experience, mm-hmm. which was that I was also a young writer, and at that point I had two books, or maybe just my first book had come out. But yeah, just that experience of going from nothing to having to publish the journals in order to get a book published. It was kind of a bit of a gauntlet, and I kind of learnt a lot along the way, I guess. And the main kind of reasons were that it seems really difficult to me that someone who has like no credits to their name, not a lot of writing experience, has to go up against people like Bill Manhire, Damien Wilkins, whoever, to get publication in journals, because you're effectively competing against these people with decades of experience and who also have a reputation already established. And so that's really difficult to do. If a journal's only got so much space, you're going to have to really show up to get in there. And there's not room for everyone. So that was kind of the idea of where it came from. So I told a few people about it, and we were like, this is a great idea. And then it was just a matter of how are we going to do it? I didn't want to start it like kind of not properly set up and it fall over. I wanted to make sure I'd done all the groundwork. So the one of the main problems was I have like almost negative technology skills. So I was like, how can I build an online journal? And so just trying to find the right platform for us to use to create a website that we could actually build and maintain. Mm-hmm. So that took a while timing wise, and it just turned out that we had been listening to a lot of podcasts that were sponsored by Squarespace, and I was like, this sounds like something I can do. They're saying it's for like really basic people with no knowledge, and I was like, great, let's have a look. And then also the timing of like having the time to create this thing and do the groundwork on it. And last year I was on the Burns Fellowship, and that was part of my proposal, was that I would create this. And I wanted to get as much done as I could in that year so that then we were kind of set up moving forward. So that's how it happened. So it was a lot of things, mostly about timing and, having the time to do it and also how to do it. So.
How did you sort of come into the picture, Frances?
How did I come into the picture? So me and Louise had edited Turbine together in 2008, because Turbine gets from the MA program at the IIML each year. They pull out two students to edit. We were the two students that year. We were both doing the MA in 08. Louise was in the poetry stream, I was in the prose, and it was awesome editing Turbine. Like, I just remember very vividly that sort of last month after we'd handed in our manuscripts, and we were just getting submissions, picking out the best stuff, pulling together an issue, and it was so much fun. So I think that's how I came into the picture, is that we had a pre-existing editorial relationship, and we knew that we could sort of not split poetry and prose, but each were sort of, I think, complementary editorial voices. Like, we often have spectacularly enjoyable arguments over what our preferred pieces are in a particular group of submissions, and it means that you have those sort of dueling but complementary views putting an issue together. We knew that we worked well together.
So with the first issue, were you guys in the same city?
So I was in Dunedin and Frances was in Wellington. So we did a lot via email and Skype. In terms of the selection, like, we would have Skype meetings and talk about it there. But this year's been really good because I couldn't really show Frances a lot of like the website side of things that easily from Dunedin. So I was like, okay, we'll sort that out this year. And so that, you know, if one of us happens to be unavailable, the other one can continue on with it. But it didn't really seem to matter too much that we're in different
cities. It's nicer to be able to sit in a room and sort of wave our hands and throw bits of paper around.
We also did that via
Skype for the first issue.
I really that. As far as online goes, like, what I'm really excited about what you're talking about is that I think a lot of people think that it's automagical, you know, but it sounds like a lot of thought went into the design. And that's one thing that I'm particularly impressed with. I was looking at it on my phone and it's beautiful. And then I looked at it on my laptop and it's beautiful. And then I looked at it on my, you know, my desktop and it's beautiful. And I just wonder, you know, like those kind of design decisions about colours and fonts and stuff like that. Was that fun to do or was it tricky, or what, can you remember, can you go back and think about those processes?
It wasn't necessarily that it was fun or tricky. I just wanted to spend all the time I could last year on getting those things right.
Yeah.
That, like, it, I mean, until you do like a massive revamp again when things get a bit tired, you don't need to worry about that.
Mm.
And I mean, the beauty of this platform is that once you've actually made your selections, even if you're building a new issue, it's still already got those selections, so right, you don't have to think about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we did spend a lot of time being really psycho last year about like what fonts we were going to use, the size of headings, the colours, all sorts of things. But I'm glad that we did, because we're fairly happy with the result, and now it's just like automatic.
And it's such a wonderful thing, you know, like, I don't know, like, this is something I really love about sort of do-it-together kind of technology, is that it means that you guys are right there with those decisions, rather than, like, handing over to a designer and a designer comes back and tells you, you know, like, it feels so much, you know, like, and I think in this weird esoteric way, the kind of editorial aesthetic kind of matches the visual aesthetic. I don't know, I just think it's really great.
Mm.
One thing I wanted to achieve through this journal is that even though it's writing by young people, it's not treated as writing by young people in the way that sometimes things can get that kind of young adult feel, in the sense that it's not, it's kind of like lesser than the old adult version.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wanted to avoid that. And I think taking the care with those decisions and treating them as serious was part of that.
Mm.
So really small things, like, remember we chose our font and we were like, we love this font, it's the greatest. But then whenever you would type something in Tadeo and use a Macron, it would show up as this in a different font.
Yes.
And it was like, so we had to change our entire font because that to us was not okay.
Yeah.
So just like along the way, there's kind of like little fine tuning things, but that we kind of wanted to take the time to get right at that point.
Yeah. It was a really good, and I mean, a big part of it is like Louise did so much of the design stuff up front, and so by the time I saw it, it just was this beautiful thing. And then getting really finickety about stuff like that, like making sure that Tadell didn't suddenly look weird if you looked at it on your phone, because for God's sake, it's New Zealand.
Yeah.
And I mean, the same, like, it's and that speaks to the diversity of the writing that we've been getting too, because, you know, we've had to make sure that we can get Chinese characters in accurately. That it all fits together.
Mm. Can we, I know we're darting all over the place with my questions, but that is something that I find incredibly amazing. And I don't know if you guys get a sense of the fact that it is younger writers, but the diversity seems massive compared with some other literary journals I can think of. You know, like, do you have any sort of feel about why that might be? And, like, maybe going back to the submissions that you got, like, can you remember, did you get a lot more submissions than you anticipated? Did you get a lot less submissions?
I think we did get more than we'd anticipated, probably. We've sort of received sort of in the area of about 100 to 120 each issue so far.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a huge wealth of material to be, and you know, very fortunate for us to be able to select from that body of submissions. And in terms of how that ties into to the diversity of authors and just the different kinds of writers, that almost seems like something that's never been hard in either of the issues. It's, if you're not getting submissions from a range of authors, something's wrong. Yeah. Like, I feel like I can't. Obviously we don't know what other journals are receiving, and there is a good range across other journals as well. But certainly from our perspective, it's not like we have to struggle to be like, let's make sure that we have X amount of views and writers represented in this. You pick the best writing, and the best writing is a diverse pool. That's what it is.
Yeah. I mean, I think the hustle is behind the scenes. So I spend a lot of time trying to get word out to a really diverse range of institutions or schools. And that's the challenge for me, is like, especially because we were a brand new journal. Nobody's heard of us. Yeah. We haven't published anything. So they're like, is this legit? And so, yeah, just trying to really reach, and it was especially important for me, like, I grew up in Gisborne, so that was part of the reason why I wanted to set this up, is like, when I was at school, I really loved writing, but I didn't have a lot of places I could submit stuff to, especially like pre-internet. I know that's really scary for probably our young writers, but yeah, like trying to reach those regions as well is really important to me. And we've also got Marty Smith, poet, and happens to be a high school teacher on board as our kind of schools coordinator. And she's been really helpful to me, like the high school system in terms of reaching teachers is just completely foreign to me. And so she's been helpful in like me trying to negotiate. Like, they've got this like forum that they all use. And yeah, it's really crazy. So getting on that and trying to let teachers know about us is like a big part of it. So I think as long as we ensure we are trying to spread the word to a diverse group of people, then you're going to get the diverse submissions coming back in.
Because that was the other thing I was thinking, is that there seems to be like there's geographical reach as well in the journal, which I think is really pretty impressive as well. And I do think that it's a wonderful thing to see, you know, year 13, year 12, you know, like just to sort of think that there are these people that are championing. And that, I guess, is another thing, is sometimes it's a bit scary to send your own work, but I guess if someone you respect kind of says, we'd love to hear from you, I think that is really an amazing thing. I think it's quite incredible. And, like, did you, do the submissions come in electronically? They do, don't they? Like, it's really easy to submit, isn't it?
Yep.
Yes, yeah.
starlingmag@gmail.com.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I wanted. I wanted it, like, and I think that's why I was so lucky with this, like, digital technology, is, like, you can, there's nothing to stop somebody in Gisborne, despite me, you know, if I, even if I haven't connected with anything they're involved in, they could just randomly find it. If they were like, I want to look up where I can submit my work to, there's nothing to stop them from finding us that way as well. So that's really cool and powerful as well.
And yeah, I mean, the huge benefit of the internet too, obviously, is that it is incredibly accessible wherever you are. Like, you know, I know sort of, you know, when you're a high school writer, you don't necessarily know all of the print journals. That's sort of a world that's a little bit, I do feel, is a little bit closed off until you're a bit older, just in terms of even knowing about it. But a website you can go to, you can share it, you can see yourself, and you can show your writing when it's been published to everyone.
Yeah, it's just so amazing. Like, I just, I don't know, like, I was just looking through again this morning, and I was just thinking again about the range of work, not necessarily the range of people writing, but the range of work, you know. Like, I think when I was around that age, I was probably just writing poetry. Like, I just thought, poetry. But one of the things I was really astounded by is there seems to be a real sort of active sort of responding to a life in writing. Like, I was just thinking about Varvara Sedovenko.
Sirorinko.
Sirorinko, that's way better.
That is my best approximation.
We like that. And her work almost slips into memoir. And I remember there have been a couple of memoirs come out by younger women lately. And I've heard a few older people sort of say, what have they got to talk about? They're only 21, you know, like, what would they know? Whereas Vivara's work is just incredible. And I just wonder, you know, when you put out the call, were you expecting mainly poetry? I guess you don't have an expectation, but can you talk a little bit about that range of genre, I suppose, like that range of, that kind of range?
Yeah. I think that, and I mean also thinking of myself when I was in high school, and I know that we've had conversations about that, I was expecting a solid range of fiction and poetry, and that was what I was imagining. But we have got quite a lot of memoir, which, and I don't know if that means that is a form that's cutting through a lot more these days. Like, because Vivara, Rebecca Hawkes did an absolutely amazing piece of, I know creative nonfiction is the term that occasionally gets bandied around, but whatever on earth it is, it's amazing. Claudia Jardine wrote in the last issue about her family and the Christchurch earthquake, and I think a really amazing piece of memoir. And I don't know if I knew that was coming. Did you know, Louise?
No, I just really had no expectations, and I think we've always advertised it as like, send us whatever you want and it will be considered. Like, there's no kind of restrictions on genre. So we've had fantasy pieces from like extracts from what the submitter says is like a huge kind of volume. We've had plays. We've had non-fiction pieces, essays. Like, there seems to be kind of no limit for these young people, which is really, really exciting, actually.
Because it is a really exciting point to hit people when maybe genre hasn't cemented itself either. I know Rebecca comes to mind, it hasn't quite settled, I guess every writer can hope for that, maybe, but to sort of say I'm not quite this yet, or I'm not quite that yet. And I think that was the thing that really I just thought was so exciting about the work. Like, the work, like, every time you flick on the next, you just have no idea what's coming up, which I think is so exciting. It's just so wonderful.
Rebecca Hawkes. Any machine can be a smoke machine if you use it wrong enough. Circe likes to live comfortably. The island, the private jet. Does putting everyone else between Skylar and Charybdis make this worth less? Hardly. Circe is moulding you in her fingers like soft wax. Here, amorphous child of Morpheus, are you comfortable? Circe takes her tax. She is a circular saw, coaxing sap from a slack, veiny tree, and in her menagerie the sad lion is left to starve and chew his stately mane for comfort. She will destroy your planet to live comfortably, but oh, she is compelling. For instance, she claims she's only anti-vaccination insofar as she is against the continuation of the existence of this human race, the world's worst disease. Abominations, bombing nations, laughing legions of senseless flesh celebrating their own unsubtlety, the syrupy pus of which she collects in a glass and holds to her lips. Bemused charmer of every snake, she has taken men to space and yet has not succeeded in getting them to respect it. She has fought 1,000 wars for you and your right to say that war is bad, although there is a comfort in it, knowing who your enemy is. Circe leaves a thick slick of spit on the panther's taut haunch, sends him off with a resounding slap, and when his whispering ear is gone, she advises you sincerely to cultivate your loneliness. Make your silence violent. Remember, a woman's first blood doesn't come from between her legs, but from biting her tongue. Circe says to treat comfort ephemerally, like a fleecy, fiery circle of ringworm on the skin of your inner thigh, a sick, unscratchable itch you don't want to show. If you admit that you need something that badly, then it can be taken away from you. Circe instructs you to become blood diamond, smoky topaz, hard-edged, undesiring object of destructiveness and self-destruction internalized by all as desire, as comfort, as Circe's white dandelion floss cat who flows down the street on his way to eat or sleep or fornicate with the mouse he doesn't keep at home, instead silently stealing out to play with her garnet heart among the licorice-scented ferns.
You've also got guest writers in both issues. Like, issue one is Vincent O'Sullivan, isn't it? Yes. And issue two is Courtney Cena Meredith. Can you talk a little bit about that decision?
Sure. I mean, it's pretty much like, who are we loving right now kind of thing. And, I mean, I guess there's a bit more to it than that, but thinking about basically the kind of kaupapa of our journal is that we are trying to create a community for young people to enter into. And so that was the idea behind having a guest writer to open up the issue and kind of lead things off. And then we also have an interview with someone. We've called it someone of note from our literary industry at the end, and that's just so that we can really be quite inclusive of just not, you know, not just writers, like really anyone who's involved sort of thing. And so I guess we're trying to think about who young people might be interested in reading their work, or really for us, like who's doing something really exciting at the moment. Like Courtney had a new book of stories coming out. She was going to Iowa. So yeah, I think, and particularly with the interviews as well, like we've just had Elle Hunt, who writes for The Guardian Australia as a journalist, and she's also quite young herself. So I was like, if I was a high school student, like that to me would be really appealing. Like I would love to know how she got to be doing that. How did she get her start? So yeah, just trying to focus on that. But at the same time, we hope that who we're featuring will also draw in a crowd, like just a general public who's interested in hearing about those people as well.
Because that's what I think is so clever about what you've done, is that audience-wise, it just seems to work. And I mean, it's so infrequently that this happens, that it seems to work for the community of people producing the work, but also be very inviting and you know, like for people outside of that community, you know what I mean? Like, I just think that it's really, it's quite an amazing thing. Like, I mean, the work is incredible, but also I can imagine it as a way, you know, if you are, you know, younger, sort of looking through there and then looking at someone else's work and, you know, someone like Nina, you know, then I imagine you see that Nina's making chapbooks, or you see that Nina's got a book out with an independent poetry press, or you know, with her book with Seraph, or you know, it just seems like so, it works so incredibly well to me, like it, you know, as an outsider, it just seems like a wonderful thing.
Yeah, well, we kind of hope it will work in that two-way direction, where the young writers might be exposed to more established people that perhaps they've never heard of, or like kind of introduce them to that world and expand their reading. And likewise, for established writers, or in fact anybody who likes reading, they will then be able to read people who maybe haven't been published at all before, get a sense of what people are doing at the moment. I met up with Vincent for a coffee, because he is just like so supportive of this, which is really lovely. I was in Dunedin the other week and met up with him. And he's, you know, saying, oh, these were my favourites from issue two, like, and I really loved this piece. And I was like, that's fantastic that, you know, someone who's had such a huge career and is so established is, like, looking at these pieces and thinking, how exciting. Like, that's perfect.
And I mean, ideally it does, and I think it has worked as a platform for those writers to actually get their name out there, but amongst that community, and we've it's been really great. We have been contacted. The spin-off wanted to publish some of Claudia's poems after she appeared in Starling. People have got in touch with us to get contact details of some of the writers to get them to read at events. Mana magazine published Moana Jane and Tai Tibble out of the first issue. That was fantastic. And you know, obviously these writers have their own platforms, like Nina is out there doing her thing everywhere. And it's amazing. But hopefully we can just be a part of their, you know, putting their name out there and making sure that, you know, they're getting heard, because like Louise says, there isn't always a ready platform for you if you're a high school writer or if you're just at university or coming out of university. It can be hard to break into some of the more established venues. Not that it's impossible by any means.
So kind of like to be able to see fresh new voices, eh?
Yeah, and to see them together as a collection of people who you might not necessarily have heard of, or if you have, they're just pushing themselves out there into the literary scene.
And like, do you mean like it's not just like this token, like, oh, we've got these two new writers here as part of this issue, like it is literally the issue is new writers. So
yeah. Because, can I talk a little bit about what that is? This might be more an editorial question and more a general question, but I was just wondering about what it is to bring together writers. Like, what does it do when, say, you put Tay Tibble next to Vivara, or, say, even, like, Oscar Bannon next to... Like, what does it mean when you do that sort of thing? Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, I mean, it's a very question, but, you know...
I mean, for me, like, it seems silly to say this, and also with, like, Twitter and stuff these days. Like, I mean, even just being connected to someone in the sense that, hey, we both had a piece published in this issue... I would have probably done that before, like gone up to you or someone else and been like, oh, hey, we were both in this. And that's like your connection. Yeah. So I think it seems probably trivial because you may not have ever met that person, but it is kind of developing a connection for them. They, you know, if Vincent is the opening act, he might be aware of you now, and that's kind of, I would imagine, really exciting. I would be excited by that as a young writer, and that, you know, if someone who knows Vincent is maybe also reading your work, and it just keeps growing. So I think there is a genuine kind of community development aspect to it, and that's probably one of the things I'm the most proud of, and like Frances was saying, like these opportunities that have come up for these writers, it's not just us saying, oh, we've helped these writers along. Like, those contacts were literally a direct result of, say, Steve Brawnius seeing that in Starling in that first issue, and I'm like, that to me is what, like, that's what I wanted to achieve.
And I mean, alongside that sort of external commonality of building connections through being in a forum together, there's also the pieces themselves often speak to one another, you know, completely unintentionally, but there are, you know, common concerns, common interests. You know, we get a lot of poems about family. We get a lot of poems about love. These are not necessarily interests that leave us when we turn 25, but I do really like the way that once we've got the poems that are going to go into an issue and the prose pieces, memoir, you can build a little bit of a conversation between the different themes and the concerns of the authors, and that's been a really, you know, that is another really enjoyable part of the editorial process.
Because I know, I mean, I guess people read things differently, but the way, like, I mean, when Starling first comes out, I generally, you know, might what's the word called, like pick a few and read them a little bit out of context. But generally what I tend to do is sit down and then just work through it. And there's such great conversations that happen while the last poem's still kind of ringing in my head, you know, to then read the next prose piece and sort of think, oh, wow, this is quite incredible, you know. And then you guys have got the biographies down the bottom, which is always interesting. I mean, I'm shallow. I'm interested in what people are up to and where they're from and that sort of thing. And I just think, which goes towards the amazing design of it as well. I think there's something really special happening in the work. I think it's probably your two editorial brains. You know, I think they're pretty amazing that they bring together this really, the whole feels bigger than the separate, you know, the sum of the parts, you know. Like, I think there's something really beautiful happening there. It's really incredible.
I mean, that's very flattering, but I wouldn't really say it's our editorial brains, because, I mean, once you've got a group of 12 pieces that you've selected, it just starts happening. Like, there's themes just start emerging, or these patterns, and I mean, it doesn't take an editorial genius to actually notice those. So I think particularly it's noticeable in the second issue, probably, in terms of like really striking groupings of themes and stuff. In that one, we kind of started out with the theme of like the physical heart, that's kind of where that started. And then there was also a lot on earthquakes, actually, which was really, like, that was unexpected. I was like, when we looked at the pieces we'd selected, we were like, hang on. So there was a piece by Anuja Mitra that was called Fault Lines, and that led into Claudia Jardine's piece on her memoir on the Christchurch earthquake. But then really weirdly, we had contacted Miriam Grace Smith, who provided the cover art, and she had sent us in a selection of pieces, and there was one that is like a crumbling city, and that was based on a series of like responses to natural disasters a few years ago. And I was like, I mean, that's spooky. So that just kind of happens, I think.
It's quite amazing. The art is incredible. Like, I was going to ask you a little bit about that. So do you contact an artist before you start designing the journal, or which way around do you do it?
So we'll generally, it's kind of similar to the guest writer and interview subject process, in the sense that we will kind of seek out someone that we think is doing something really interesting. I generally try to aim for an artist who is also under 25, because I'm like, that's kind of a nice way to get them a new audience, and also, again, that kind of promotion of younger artists in those fields. But it's a bit more tricky, because it's not my area of expertise, and I don't have a big community just to draw upon. But there's definitely been contacts that I've used. So when I was in Dunedin, there's the Blue Oyster Gallery there, and I contacted them, and they put me onto Ella for our first issue. And then for the second issue, I mean, this is just personal context, which I am friends on Facebook with Briar Grace Smith, who we were also in the class with in the MA. And so, because Miriama is her daughter, I see all her liking Miriama's art, and I was like, that's amazing. So just contacted her that way. It's not too complicated. It's just really like what's around and what we're interested in, and just kind of trying to find these young people doing these amazing things in the art world as well.
Because it really is beautiful. Like, I just think it's wonderful. I think they're so good. When you look at all these submissions, this is a question, I don't know, I always, when I talk to people that are submitting work, they're interested in this, how do you know that's one that goes in the, I'm going to show Louise that one pile?
I feel like it's like a really instinctive process. Like, there's not a sort of magic equation. I think this is true of all writing, really. But it is, you know, you sit down and you read everything, and you put some stuff, you know, some stuff into the I need to read this again pile, just, you know, I think that this is something, but I need to come back to it with fresh eyes. And then sometimes something will just, like, reach out and grab you.
Mm-hmm.
And then I text Louise and I say, we've got to put this in. It can be hard to pinpoint it because it's all different sorts of things. But in particular, there's that feeling that you look for of, like, I've never read this before. Mm. That's the guiding star, if anything, of, like, is this something that the feeling of saying something new and unexpected or beautiful or thought-provoking or...
Yeah.
But something that jolts you.
Mm.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think people really need to think about the fact that to be able to look at your own writing and think, is this my own voice? Is this a unique voice? And then remember that it's going to be in a pile of more than 100 other people. So is it really going to be able to stand out from there?
Mm.
Because isolated, you know, you can kind of say, yeah, nobody else writes like this, but is there going to be anything else in that 100 that sounds the same? Like, that's kind of what I would encourage people to be thinking about.
And reading seems like such an important facet of that, eh? Like, reading your journal, sort of getting it.
Well, that's another really big hope that I have for the journal, and already I'm hearing back from school teachers and stuff, which is really heartening, that for them it's a way to, like, it's a resource as well that they can use in their classroom. And even, I mean, if it's not high school, you know, people in their early 20s, I remember that, like, sometimes it's kind of daunting to know where to start reading. Like, you're like, you know, go to the library and look up poetry. I mean, where do you even begin? And how do you begin to find voices that resonate with you? So this is kind of, I like to think it's a really good resource, because we've already done a lot of the legwork of picking a few people out, and it's a bit like, you know, a sampler box, and you can kind of have a read through, and there'll be something, hopefully, that, you know, at least one thing that people enjoy in there. And so, in that sense, it's a good reading resource for teachers, for writers, you know. It's got that aspect to it as well.
And I think there is real value to reading other young writers, like, because it's easy when you're in high school, when you're just starting university, you're being given
old dead white dude.
Yeah, basically. I was thinking, which old dead white man shall I pick as my example of who you get given when you're in high school? So when you're reading Wordsworth, as our chosen dead white man of the moment, it all seems very distant.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't think, or, you know, except in your most sort of optimistic and ego boosted moment, like, yes, I could definitely be Wordsworth. This is something that feels like me. But there is something, and, you know, I remember this too, being a young writer, when you get into workshops, when you start, you know, or when you're in high school and you're in writing groups, being able to read something by someone who is the same age as you or close to, and being like, right, this is something that is, you know, it may well be completely different from the sort of thing you're writing. You might be a prose writer and you're reading a poet, but that excites you and that you can relate to, and that also there's just a certain permission that comes with that, like, you can do this too.
Sharon Lamb, current mood, jam, birth control, pears, fish, whooshy ding noise on your iPhone, at the market, oh God, I'm so alone, starts talking about pastries, Kickstarter to fund my tap lessons, I've stayed up to watch movies for journalistic reasons, at the market, why are apples so expensive, a cool hip piece about iPhones, Tinder as a laxative, my neck while serving customers, moss enthusiasts of the world unite, thank you, hold the applause, and binge eat alone in bed instead. Moss enthusiasts of the world unite. We're a happy family in my head.
How do you tune your... Do you think there's exercises that an editor needs to do to keep tuned? I don't know. Like, is it just reading lots? Or, like, is it... Do you think writing and editing go together well?
I mean, I think for me, I was completely against being a solo editor for myself. I want a partner because I don't think that's healthy for me to be like, oh, this is great. Oh, yes, Louise, it is great. Okay, it's decided. Like, I need someone to challenge me and to kind of hold me accountable.
Yeah.
And Francis is that person. And I would like to say that I think a lot of people think Francis is the nice guy, but he can really dig his heels in about something. And I'll be like, okay, fine, Francis, you can have your way. But,
yes.
Yeah, like, I think... I mean, our relationship is great because obviously we sound like an old married couple now. But, yeah, we can... There's, like, the respect there that I value Francis' opinion. If he feels really strongly about something, I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll go with you on that. Mm-hmm. And in the most part, we have the same... Like, we have a good crossover. Like, mm-hmm. the majority mm-hmm. we will both kind of... We read independently and we make our selections independently and then we come together... And it turns out there's, like, a huge crossover of people that we've both selected. But then on the fringe, there'll be a few people on Francis' side, a few people on my side. And that's just our different kind of tastes at that point. And, and so we kind of blend those together. But, yeah, for me, I think I don't do any exercises or, you know, anything. But I think having someone else to keep you on your toes is really important because I don't want it to turn into like a dictatorship where I'm just making all these decisions myself. That's horrible. And it's also not very fun.
No.
So, yeah.
You know, I mean, exactly what Louise said, basically. Like, it is amazing how... Because you read, we do that separate reading. We read everything, you know, apart from occasionally getting super excited and texting each other. You know, we come up with our list of, like, this is what I reckon, you know, should be in the issue. And then you come together and Louise will be like, but what about this? And you realise that just, you know, you can't, sometimes you miss things.
Mm.
And it does mean, I think, that we... I think we net nearly everything each issue so far in terms of this is the top pieces that we received. Because, it is amazing how sometimes Louise will be like, but you forgot this person. You're like, oh, my God, this is amazing.
Yeah, and I think there's that exercise of having to fight for something is sometimes quite great, actually. You know, I think, I don't know, sometimes, I don't know, you've probably had it as well, but sometimes in workshop there'll be one person saying, you know, kill the king, and there'll be someone else saying, keep the king. And it's quite nice to have that readerly intellectual kind of response to a piece where you are saying, no, actually, you know, this is what's turning me on about it. This is what's making me want to keep it. And, you know, like, I hear what you're saying and just kind of going deeper and deeper into what it is about what's working for it.
I mean, and that's the same principles as you use in your own work. Like,
what
would I fight for? And sometimes when we are selecting things, I'll feel really strongly about something and then I'll get to it and I'll be like, actually, I changed my mind. Like, this isn't something that I am, you know, has enough for me to really, like, go into bat for it kind of thing. And it's the same with your own work, like deciding what really needs to be in there and what doesn't is like all about, you know, what if my editor came back and said, actually, I want you to get rid of that, would I be like, sorry, I can't, or would I be like, okay, yeah, I get what you're saying, I'll let that one go.
Yeah. I think we're almost there, but I was just wondering a little bit if you both wanted to talk a little bit about writing practice. From it sounds like both of you were writing from a youngish age. Can you talk a little, I mean this is crazy, but almost like an autobiography of that writing practice, like, I mean, did it, like, so it starts at school jotting down the odd thing, the MA comes along. What does your writing look like today? Like, what does it, like, we were all talking about it before we started writing and how difficult it is to find, you know, to eat and pay rent and also write. But what do you want to talk a little bit about that now?
Sure. Do you want to go first?
Sure. there's a lot in there. Just trying to work out where to start. I do think that the community that you create, the writing community that you create, and it does really exist sort of in, you know, in all these different pockets around the country, but Wellington obviously has a particularly deep pocket, it's something that really sustains and motivates seems like the wrong word, but can sort of feed the writing process. Like, I know that, so yeah, you're in high school, you're writing, and actually at high school, like I was at Wellington High School, and we had an amazing writing group when I was in third and fourth form that then sort of fell apart, but shout out to Ms. Linsky, the greatest English teacher in all of New Zealand, who drove that writing class and sort of pulled us all together. And I mean, at that stage, I think, gosh, who was in that? I'm not going to try and name names. They'd probably be terrified if I did. And so you're doing that and you have your little pockets of community at school amongst your friends. But then the way that... and I do credit the IIML a lot for this. I know it sometimes comes in for a bit of stick and people can be like, oh, yeah.
Oh, we all sound the same.
Well, and also the idea that it's sort of a gatekeeper that, you know, you get into the IIML and then you've got the secret handshake. And
but showed me.
Yeah. But for me, like, because I did a series of the undergraduate workshops when I was at university, and then obviously the MA with Louise and our wonderful classmates that year, it's just a chance to meet other writers and build up those relationships that mean that 6-7 years later you're suddenly editing a journal together and you send each other your work, and that's what can sustain and drive that work. I don't even know if I've answered your question.
That's another good answer. I think it's a really good answer because I think it does tie in, like, I mean, I just to what I was saying before, like, I mean, you know, often at school there is a champion, you know, there is someone that you write something and it comes back and they say, this is really good, have you thought about this, da, da, da. Or you have those friends around you, and I think it's a lot harder, you know, it's a lot harder to be out in the world sometimes and sort of say to yourself, yes, here I am, one man, you know, like, what I've got to say is worthwhile, you know, like, well, it's worthwhile me sitting down for an hour and doing this. And I think those communities are so important, and I think that's what's exciting about this project, is that it is building communities. What about you, Louise? Like, how does that work in your life?
I guess, like, a slightly different experience for me. So, like I say, I went to high school in Gisborne, which was fine. We didn't have any kind of creative writing group or anything. We just had English. So there wasn't really an organised way for me to engage with creative writing. From teaching at Massey and things like that, I always try to go back to that time because I really hated poetry in high school. I did not connect to it at all. And that's literally because I was being shown things like Wordsworth, or in terms of New Zealand writing, things like Dennis Glover, or like quite blokey stuff that I was like, I don't really connect to that either. It was never an interest of mine, I guess, like poetry. I knew I loved reading and writing, and I was probably trying to write like fiction pieces and stuff at that time, because that's the only other option that I knew about. It really wasn't until I got to uni and kind of started engaging in the world of poetry and realizing that it wasn't a lot of that stuff that I thought it was, and there were other ways of going about it, that I started kind of connecting to that. And then, yeah, I also did an undergraduate course at the IIML when I was 19, and like Frances says, Chris Teese is one of my great friends, and I met him, you know, 14 years ago on that course, and we still swap work and give each other feedback. Those connections are really important. And again, this kind of feeds into why I set up Starling. Once I'd done that and I really decided, I mean, I didn't decide, I just was like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do. And I've felt really strongly about that ever since that age. I've really got blinkers on, like, this, I know this is what I want to do and what I need to be doing. And so I was quite focused on, like, how do I, you know, I'm playing the long game here. How do I progress in this career. So in my early 20s, I was living in Japan, actually, but I've still got it. I keep this like psycho folder of I had like and back in the day, you know, we weren't sending things by email back then. We were printing things off and posting them. So I kept a second copy in a clear file saying who I'd submitted it to, the date, if I was waiting for a reply. And, you know, I it was like a job to me. Like I would spend, you know, a day on the weekend doing this, sending things out, waiting to hear back, compiling submissions. And so that's part of the logic behind selling for me, is that that is a learning process, and I guess providing another platform to for people to be able to do that is important to me. So that's, I guess, where I'm coming from with it, that it's serious. I felt seriously about it in my early 20s, so why wouldn't other people? And I think they want their work to be treated seriously, just like I did. So this is kind of the platform to give them that.
It's so good to hear that, because I know when I was, I sort of started writing around about 19 or 20, and I really had this idea that what happened was you wrote in your room quietly, you went out and drank a lot, that seemed to be quite important, and you sort of lounged around bars, and then someone would say, don't you write poetry? And then they would grab your work and you'd become famous, you know, like. And it wasn't until I was probably in my 30s, you know, like, that I suddenly realized that, oh, actually, no one's knocking on my door for my latest poetry. I actually do need to submit it. And I think, I think it's just so good for you to provide a platform where part of that graph can kind of be learnt in an atmosphere where, you know, like, you send it, you keep your spreadsheet and you send it away. And yeah, I just think it's so great.
Yeah, and part of that is not nice. Sometimes it's being rejected.
Yep.
And yes. People ask us about that. And yes, for 90% of people who submit to Starling, that is also true. But I think that's part of this life, and we can't protect people from that just because they're under 25. Like, it's something that you have to learn how to handle and how to keep moving forward with. We try to do it as nicely as we can. So if at the moment, because the submission numbers are manageable for us, I don't know, you know, if we will be able to continue this depending on how it grows, but anyone who's come quite close to being accepted, or also for high school students, we try to include a line in our email if we're not accepting the work, saying this is what we really liked about your work, and here's something that might help you to kind of improve this piece. Or but it is, it's a part of it. And again, I don't think young people want to be protected from that, because, like I say, if they're wanting, you know, they are wanting their work to be treated seriously, and being rejected is sometimes a part of that as well.
It's a huge part of it. It's a huge part of the job, isn't it? Do you have a trick for getting over rejection, Francis? Or have you never had a piece rejected?
Oh my God. I was about to say, obviously 100%. We've all been there. I have had so much stuff rejected.
I feel like I've got an Olympic medal.
Like,
my friend Helen always says that you're allowed 12 hours of grumpiness, and then you just got to get on with shit. What do you reckon?
It's always a weird thing. And sometimes this is true of the workshop processes, because people will, you know, you'll present something in a workshop and people will be like, well, I thought it sucked. Sometimes a bit more nicely than that.
but that's how it can sound.
and there's this funny thing of, you know, half the time, or often more than half the time, they'll say, you know, I don't think this is ready yet, or this is not good and this is why, or you need to work on this more. And you're like, actually, you're right. Like, deep in yourself, you're like, this is something that I'm still, that still isn't there yet, or that maybe it wasn't a great idea to begin with and I need to do something else. And then there's the other side of the coin, you know, 25% of the time where you're like, no, I know that this is something that I feel and that I want to push on with. And that's the other side of it. We are still going to get it wrong sometimes. Sometimes something gets rejected and it just, it wasn't the right forum for it, and we're not pretending to be the only only forum for young writers by any means.
Yeah.
There's so many places that, you know, I'm you know, I love our platform, but if you want to send, you know, start up your own Tumblr page and put it out there, like there's like listen to criticism, like think about it, have that 12-hour moment, but also just listen to yourself, and like sometimes you'll get something back and you'll be like, yes, that's right, and sometimes there will be a belligerent part of you that is like, no, I know that this is something that I want to say, and also trust that part. Not implicitly, sometimes your gut leads you wrong, but
and I mean this is the wonderful thing about writing, because really in the end no one cares as much as me, you know what I mean? Like, I mean in the end it's kind of like I, you know, like it's my Sudoku or it's my crossword or it's my, you know, and it is a pretty empowering thing to, you know, I know that is, I've never heard it expressed that well, but yeah, I do, you know, like I say, sometimes things will come back and I'll just be like, idiots! And you know, and then sometimes things will come back and I'll go, oh no. That's more often that way. So is there anything else we need to know about Starling that we haven't covered today?
I mean, I don't know. I've written down like all these things, but I think, I think the thing that I ended with was, I think you had a question about like what story that like over time and with the issues together, what do we think like the overarching story is? And I was saying to Francis before we started, the thing that is really great to me is that it's writer led. Like, we actually have nothing to do with the story that's being told over time. It's what's important to all these new voices coming through. They're kind of directing us as to what they want to say. And I'm really, I feel excited to find out what the story is going to be over time. And so I think that's cool for me. Like, I'm kind of reading along going, oh, where are we going to go?
Because there is that excitement, isn't there? I just realised that come the next issue, there's a whole new group of year 13, year 12, first year university, second year university, you know, like there's a whole, there's a whole new cohort sort of coming through all the time. And plus, I feel like there is a real, there's kind of a living with all faces open that happens, I think, around, you know, like that means that the work will reflect that kind of living as well, eh? That's really great. What about you, Francis?
The main thing for me, honestly, is just, like Louise says, we're not the important factor in this. The important thing is the writer. And just go and read it, because there's so much good stuff that people are really sending in. Like, it does feel like a privilege when you sort of, when we've put the issue together and you sit down and you read it on the day that we release it, and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, people, just everyone, but from, you know, all the different amazing writers that are doing stuff out there, from, you know, Rebecca Hawkes, Tay Tibble, Lily Ng, Emma Shee. I could sit here and just read down the page, because there's so much interesting, exciting stuff. And
I think the gratifying thing for us is like, I mean, when you're trying to, as we were talking about, when you're trying to work a full-time job and now do this on the side as well, it can be challenging and like quite tiring at times, and sometimes you think, oh God, like, I hope, you know, this is for a purpose and it's working out, kind of thing. But then with the last issue, we sent out the acceptance emails to the 12 writers, and every single person replied saying thank you so much. For some of them, they were saying, this is my first ever publication. It's so amazing, I'm so happy. And I was like, okay, that's why we're doing it. So I try to keep those so that we can look back at those and think, oh yeah, okay, it is for these writers, it is making a difference to them.
I just think it's incredible. Like, I mean, all age aside, and I think this is to your credit with the kaupapa of the journal, you know, like, it doesn't seem to be age driven. I mean, you know, it doesn't seem to treat this work any differently to any other work, and I just think that it's such a marvelous publication. Like, I just so love reading it, and it's exciting, and I just feel very excited for the future. And thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
Leaves by Lily Ng. After the revolution, all my pal and Yaya owned was a wide-brimmed sun hat that her husband wove from reeds. Pretend, he said. You are a grand lady tending the palace garden. But the regime was relentless. Her body became the brown ochre of falling leaves. One night in June, the Daping River swallowed her, a single dark leaf smuggled away on the Hong Kong current. Strong hands from Gong Xiao pulled her ashore, stole her a scarf to cover her dusky skin. In Lyle Bay, Yaya and her new son, the evangelical anglicized Ken, my father, hands me photos of a baby in buttercream yellow blankets, swaddled tighter than they ought to be. Do you remember that feeling? Deep pressure in your sternum. Wrinkled brown hands wrap over and over. A ballast tied down in a storm. My agony was her autumn. Hair dropping like acorns. Spine shriveling, chest caving, a rot that ate her from the inside she would rasp deciduous fingers against my face. Xiao Lili, my darling, her touch whispered. Fear neither heaven nor earth.